31. The story never did get out. Oh, I don't mean that Ray Brower's body was never found. It was. But neither our gang nor their gang got the credit. In the end, Ace must have decided that an anonymous phone call was the safest course, because that's how the location of the corpse was reported. What I meant was that none of our parents ever found out what we'd been up to that Labor Day weekend. Chris's dad was still drinking, just as Chris had said he would be. His mom had gone off to Lewiston to stay with her sister, the way she almost always did when Mr. Chambers was on a bender. She went and left Eyeball in charge of the younger kids. Eyeball had fulfilled his responsibility by going off with Ace and his J.D. buddies, leaving 9-year-old Sheldon, 5-year-old Emery, and 2-year-old Deborah to sink or swim on their own. Teddy's mom got worried the second night and called Vern's mom. Vern's mom, who was also never going to do the game show circuit, said we were still out in Vern's tent. She knew because she had seen a light on in there the night before. Teddy's mom said she sure hoped no one was smoking cigarettes in there, and Vern's mom said it looked like a flashlight to her, and besides, she was sure that none of Vern's or Billy's friends smoked. My dad asked me some vague questions, looking mildly troubled at my evasive answers, said we'd go fishing together sometime, and that was the end of it. If the parents had gotten together in the week or two afterward, everything would have fallen down, but they never did. Milo Pressman never spoke up either. My guess is that he thought twice about it being our word against his, and how we would all swear that he sicked Chopper on me. So, the story never came out. But that wasn't the end of it. One day near the end of the month, while I was walking home from school, a black 1952 Ford cut into the curb in front of me. There was no mistaking that car. Gangster white walls and spinner hubcaps, high-rise chrome bumpers and lucite death knob with a rose embedded in it clamped to the steering wheel. Painted on the back deck was a deuce and a one-eyed jack. Beneath them, in Roman Gothic script, were the words Wild Card. The doors flew open. Ace Merrill and Fuzzy Brackowitz stepped out. "Cheap hood, right?" Ace said, smiling his gentle smile. "My mother loves the way I do it to her, right?" "We're gonna rack you, baby," Fuzzy said. I dropped my school books on the sidewalk and ran. I was busting my buns, but they caught me before I even made the end of the block. Ace hit me with a flying tackle, and I went full length on the paving. My chin hit the cement, and I didn't just see stars. I saw whole constellations, whole nebulae. I was already crying when they picked me up, not so much from my elbows and knees, both pairs scraped and bleeding, or even from fear. It was vast, impotent rage that made me cry. Chris was right. He had been ours. I twisted and turned and almost squiggled free. Then Fuzzy hoiked his knee into my crotch. The pain was amazing, incredible, nonpareil. It widened the horizons of pain from plain old widescreen to a vista vision. I began to scream. Screaming seemed to be my best chance. Ace punched me twice in the face, long and looping haymaker blows. The first one closed my left eye. It would be 4 days before I was really able to see out of that eye again. The second broke my nose with a crunch that sounded the way crispy cereal sounds inside your head when you chew. Then old Mrs. Chalmers came out on the porch, with her cane clutched in one arthritis-twisted hand and a Herbert Tarryton jutting from one corner of her mouth. She began to bellow at them. "Hey! Hey there, you boys! You stop that! Police! Police!" "Don't let me see you around, dipshit," Ace said, smiling, and they let go of me and backed off. I sat up and then leaned over, cupping my wounded balls, sickly sure I was going to throw up and then die. I was still crying, too. But when Fuzzy started to walk around me, the sight of his pegged jeans leg snugged down over the top of his motorcycle boot brought all the fury back. I grabbed him and bit his calf through his jeans. I bit him just as hard as I could. Fuzzy began to do a little screaming of his own. He also began hopping around on one leg, and incredibly he was calling me a dirty fighter. I was watching him hop around, and that was when Ace stamped down on my left hand, breaking the first two fingers. I heard them break. They didn't sound like crispy cereal. They sounded like pretzels. Then Ace and Fuzzy were going back to Ace's 52, Ace sauntering with his hands in his back pockets, Fuzzy hopping on one leg and throwing curses back over his shoulder at me. I curled up on the sidewalk, crying. Aunt Evie Chalmers came down her walk. thudding her cane angrily as she came. She asked me if I needed the doctor. I sat up and managed to stop most of the crying. I told her I didn't. Bullshit! She bellowed. Aunt Evie was deaf and bellowed everything. I saw where that bully got you, boy. Your sweetmeats are going to swell up the size of mason jars. She took me into her house, gave me a wet rag for my nose. It had begun to resemble a summer squash by then, and gave me a big cup of medicinal-tasting coffee that was somehow calming. She kept bellowing at me that she should call the doctor, and I kept telling her not to. Finally, she gave up, and I walked home. Very slowly, I walked home. My balls weren't the size of mason jars yet, but they were on their way. My mom and dad got a look at me and wigged right out. I was sort of surprised that they noticed anything at all, to tell the truth. Who were the boys? Could I pick them out of a lineup? That from my father, who never missed Naked City and The Untouchables. I said I didn't think I could pick the boys out of a lineup. I said I was tired. Actually, I think I was in shock. In shock and more than a little drunk from Aunt Evie's coffee, which must have been at least 60% VSOP brandy. I said I thought they were from some other town or from up the city, a phrase everyone understood to mean Lewiston, Auburn. They took me to Dr. Clarkson in the station wagon. Dr. Clarkson, who is still alive today, was even then old enough to have quite possibly been on armchair-to-armchair terms with God. He set my nose and my fingers and gave my mother a prescription for painkiller. Then he got them out of the examining room on some pretext or other and came over to me, shuffling, head forward, like Boris Karloff approaching Igor. Who did it, Gordon? I don't know, Dr. Clarkson. You're lying. No, sir. Uh-uh. His sallow cheeks began to flow with color. Why should you protect the cretins who did this? Do you think they will respect you? They will laugh and call you stupid fool. Oh, they'll say, there goes the stupid fool we beat up for kicks the other day. Ha, ha, hoo, hoo, hardy, hardy, har. I didn't know them, really. I could see his hands itching to shake me, but of course he couldn't do that. So he sent me out to my parents, shaking his white head and muttering about juvenile delinquents. He would no doubt tell his old friend God all about it that night over their cigars and sherry. I didn't care if Ace and Fuzzy and the rest of those assholes respected me or thought I was stupid or never thought about me at all. But there was Chris to think of. His brother Eyeball had broken his arm in two places and had left his face looking like a Canadian sunrise. They had to set the elbow break with a steel pin. Mrs. McGinn from down the road saw Chris staggering along the soft shoulder, bleeding from both ears and reading a Richie Rich comic book. She took him to the CMG emergency room, where Chris told the doctor he had fallen down the cellar stairs in the dark. Right, the doctor said, every bit as disgusted with Chris as Dr. Clarkson had been with me. And then he went to call Constable Bannerman. While he did that from his office, Chris went slowly down the hall, holding the temporary sling against his chest, so the arm wouldn't swing and grate the broken bones together, and used a nickel in the payphone to call Mrs. McGinn. He told me later it was the first collect call he had ever made, and he was scared to death that she wouldn't accept the charges, but she did. "Chris, are you all right?" she asked. "Yes, thank you," Chris said. "I'm sorry I couldn't stay with you, Chris, but I had pies and..." "That's all right, Mrs. McGinn," Chris said. "Can you see the Buick in our dooryard?" The Buick was the car Chris's mother drove. It was 10 years old, and when the engine got hot, it smelled like frying hush puppies. "It's there," she said cautiously. "Best not to mix in too much with the Chambers's poor white trash. Shanty Irish. Would you go over and tell Mama to go downstairs and take the light bulb out of the socket in the cellar?" "Chris, I really... my pies..." "Tell her," Chris said implacably, "to do it right away. Unless maybe she wants my brother to go to jail." There was a long... long pause, and then Mrs. McGinn agreed. She asked no questions, and Chris told her no lies. Constable Bannerman did indeed come out to the Chambers house, but Richie Chambers didn't go to jail. Vern and Teddy took their lumps, too, although not as bad as either Chris or I. Billy was laying for Vern when Vern got home. He took after him with a stove length and hit him hard enough to knock him unconscious after only 4 or 5 good licks. Vern was no more than stunned, but Billy got scared he might have killed him and stopped. 3 of them caught Teddy walking home from the vacant lot one afternoon. They punched him out and broke his glasses. He fought them, but they wouldn't fight him when they realized he was groping after them like a blind man in the dark. We hung out together at school, looking like the remains of a Korean assault force. Nobody knew exactly what had happened, but everybody understood that we'd had a pretty serious run-in with the big kids and comported ourselves like men. A few stories went around. All of them were wildly wrong. When the casts came off and the bruises healed, Vern and Teddy just drifted away. They had discovered a whole new group of contemporaries that they could lord it over. Most of them were real wets, scabby, scrubby little fifth-grade assholes. But Vern and Teddy kept bringing them to the treehouse, ordering them around, strutting like Nazi generals. Chris and I began to drop by there less and less frequently, and after a while the place was theirs by default. I remember going up one time in the spring of 1961 and noticing that the place smelled like a shoot-off in a haymow. I never went there again, that I can recall. Teddy and Vern slowly became just two more faces in the halls or in 3:30 detention. We nodded and said hi. That was all. It happens. Friends come in and out of your life like busboys in a restaurant. Did you ever notice that? But when I think of that dream, the corpses under the water pulling implacably at my legs, it seems right that it should be that way. Some people drown, that's all. It's not fair, but it happens. Some people drown. 33. Vern Tessio was killed in a house fire that swept a Lewiston apartment building in 1966. In Brooklyn and the Bronx, they call that sort of apartment building a slum tenement, I believe. The fire department said it started around 2 in the morning, and the entire building was nothing but cinders in the cellar hole by dawn. There had been a large drunken party. Vern was there. Someone fell asleep in one of the bedrooms with a live cigarette going. Vern himself, maybe, drifting off, dreaming of his pennies. They identified him and the four others who died by their teeth. Teddy went in a squalid car crash. That was 1971, I think, or maybe it was early 1972. There used to be a saying when I was growing up, if you go out alone, you're a hero. Take somebody else with you and you're dog piss. Teddy, who had wanted nothing but the service since the time he was old enough to want anything, was turned down by the Air Force and classified 4F by the draft. Anyone who had seen his glasses and his hearing aid knew it was going to happen, anyone but Teddy. In his junior year at high school, he got a 3-day vacation from school for calling the guidance counselor a lying sack of shit. The GO had observed Teddy coming in every so often, like every day, and checking over his career board for new service literature. He told Teddy that maybe he should think about another career, and that was when Teddy blew his stack. He was held back a year for repeated absences, tardies, and the attendant flunked courses, but he did graduate. He had an ancient Chevrolet Bel Air, and he used to hang around the places where Ace and Fuzzy and the rest had hung around before him. The pool hall, the dance hall, Suki's Tavern, which is closed now, and the Mellow Tiger, which isn't. He eventually got a job with the Castle Rock Public Works Department, filling up holes with hot patch. The crash happened over in Harlow. Teddy's Bel Air was full of his friends. Two of them had been part of that group he and Vern took to bossing around way back in 1960. And they were all passing around a couple of joints and a couple of bottles of pop-off. They hit a utility pole and sheared it off, and the Chevrolet rolled 6 times. One girl came out technically still alive. She lay for 6 months in what the nurses and orderlies at Central Maine General called the C&T ward, cabbages and turnips. Then some merciful phantom pulled the plug on her respirator. Teddy Duchamp was posthumously awarded the Dog Piss of the Year award. Chris enrolled in the college courses in his second year of junior high. He and I both knew that if we waited any longer, it would be too late. He would never catch up. Everyone jawed at him about it. His parents, who thought he was putting on airs, his friends, most of whom dismissed him as a pussy, the guidance counselor who didn't believe he could do the work, and most of all the teachers, who didn't approve of this duck-tailed, leather-jacketed, engineer-booted apparition who had materialized without warning in their classrooms. You could see that the sight of those boots and that many-zipper jacket offended them in connection with such high-minded subjects as algebra, Latin, and earth science. Such attire was meant for the shop courses only. Chris sat among the well-dressed, vivacious boys and girls from the middle-class families in Castle View and Brickyard Hill, like some silent, brooding Grendel that might turn on them at any moment, produce a horrible roaring like the sound of dual glass-pack mufflers, and gobble them up, penny loafers, Peter Pan collars, button-down paisley shirts and all. He almost quit a dozen times that year. His father in particular hounded him, accusing Chris of thinking he was better than his old man, accusing Chris of wanting to go up there to the college so you can turn me into a bankrupt. He once broke a Rheingold bottle over the back of Chris's head, and Chris wound up in the CMG emergency room again, where it took 4 stitches to close his scalp. His old friends, most of whom were now majoring in smoking area, catcalled him on the streets. The guidance counselor huckstered him to take at least some shop courses so he wouldn't flunk the whole slate. Worst of all, of course, was just this. He'd been fucking off for the entire first 7 years of his public education, and now the bill had come due with a vengeance. We studied together almost every night, sometimes for as long as 6 hours at a stretch. I always came away from those sessions exhausted, and sometimes I came away frightened as well, frightened by his incredulous rage at just how murderously high that bill was. Before he could even begin to understand introductory algebra, he had to relearn the fractions that he and Teddy and Vern had played pocket pool through in the 5th grade. Before he could even begin to understand Pater Noster qui est in caelis, he had to be told what nouns and prepositions and objects were. On the inside of his English grammar, neatly lettered, were the words, "Fuck gerunds." His compositional ideas were good, and not badly organized, but his grammar was bad, and he approached the whole business of punctuation as if with a shotgun. He wore out his copy of Warriner's and bought another in a Portland bookstore. It was the first hardcover book he actually owned, and it became a queer sort of Bible to him. But by our junior year in high school, he had been accepted. Neither of us made top honors, but I came out 7th, and Chris stood 19th. We were both accepted at the University of Maine, but I went to the Orono campus while Chris enrolled at the Portland campus. Pre-law, can you believe that? More Latin. We both dated through high school, but no girl ever came between us. Does that sound like we went faggot? It would have to most of our old friends, Vern and Teddy included. But it was only survival. We were clinging to each other in deep water. I've explained about Chris, I think. My reasons for clinging to him were less definable. His desire to get away from Castle Rock and out of the mill's shadows seemed to be my best part. And I could not just leave him to sink or swim on his own. If he had drowned, that part of me would have drowned with him, I think. Near the end of 1971, Chris went into a Chicken Delight in Portland to get a 3-piece snack bucket. Just ahead of him, 2 men started arguing about which one had been first in line. One of them pulled a knife. Chris, who had always been the best of us at making peace, stepped between them and was stabbed in the throat. The man with the knife had spent time in 4 different institutions. He had been released from Shawshank State Prison only the week before. Chris died almost instantly. I read about it in the paper. Chris had been finishing his 2nd year of graduate studies. Me, I had been married 1.5 years and was teaching high school English. My wife was pregnant, and I was trying to write a book. When I read the news item, "Student fatally stabbed in Portland restaurant," I told my wife I was going out for a milkshake. I drove out of town, parked, and cried for him. Cried for damn near 30 minutes, I guess. I couldn't have done that in front of my wife, much as I love her. It would have been pussy. 34. Me? I'm a writer now, like I said. A lot of critics think what I write is shit. A lot of the time I think they're right. But it still freaks me out to put those words "freelance writer" down in the occupation blank of the forms you have to fill out at credit desks and in doctor's offices. My story sounds so much like a fairy tale, and it's fucking absurd. I sold the book, and it was made into a movie, and the movie got good reviews, and it was a smash hit besides. This had all happened by the time I was 26. The 2nd book was made into a movie as well, as was the 3rd. I told you, it's fucking absurd. Meantime, my wife doesn't seem to mind having me around the house, and we have 3 kids now. They all seem perfect to me, and most of the time I'm happy. But like I said, the writing isn't so easy or as much fun as it used to be. The phone rings a lot. Sometimes I get headaches, bad ones, and then I have to go into a dim room and lie down until they go away. The doctor says they aren't true migraines. He called them stress aches and told me to slow down. I worry about myself sometimes. What a stupid habit that is. And yet I can't quite seem to stop it. And I wonder if there is really any point to what I'm doing, or what I'm supposed to make of a world where a man can get rich playing Let's Pretend. But it's funny how I saw Ace Merrill again. My friends are dead, but Ace is alive. I saw him pulling out of the mill parking lot just after the 3 o'clock whistle the last time I took my kids down home to see my dad. The 52 Ford had become a 77 Ford station wagon. A faded bumper sticker said, Reagan Bush, 1980. His hair was mowed into a crew cut and he'd gotten fat. The sharp, handsome features I remembered were buried in an avalanche of flesh. I had left the kids with Dad long enough to go downtown and get the paper. I was standing on the corner of Main and Carbine, and he glanced at me as I waited to cross. There was no sign of recognition on the face of this 32-year-old man who had broken my nose in another dimension of time. I watched him wheel the Ford wagon into the dirt parking lot beside the Mellow Tiger, get out, hitch at his pants, and walk inside. I could imagine the brief wedge of country western as he opened the door, the brief sour whiff of Nick and Gansett on draft, the welcoming shouts of the other regulars as he closed the door and placed his large ass on the same stool which had probably held him up for at least 3 hours every day of his life, except Sundays, since he was 21. I thought, so that's what Ace is now. I looked to the left, and beyond the mill, I could see the Castle River, not so wide now, but a little cleaner, still flowing under the bridge between Castle Rock and Harlow. The trestle upstream is gone, but the river is still around. So am I.
The End. You've been listening to The Body, from Different Seasons, by Stephen King. Narrated by Frank Muller.